available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Welcome to Outlook. I'm Peter Walters, and this edition is being recorded on Wednesday, the 17th of December, 2025. Coming up in the programme, well, it's all about Christmas, really, isn't it? Carols, etc., etc. But first, we're going to have the news from our readers this week, Peter and Elaine.
Outlook News.
Three ambulances filled with Christmas gifts and medical supplies have arrived in Ukraine, having journeyed from Warwickshire. The ambulances were sent by the Belvedere Community Organisation, which is based in Leamington Spa, who have now delivered 61 ambulances filled with aid to Ukraine. Belvedere said the gifts and supplies would be distributed by the Sisters of St. Joseph, reaching children in orphanages and elderly residents in care homes. Volunteer Harnek Singh said, "It was a great adventure, but above all, it felt meaningful to have done something to make a real difference. It was humbling to meet the soldiers who travelled from the front line to meet us." The vehicles were funded by LKQ Euro Car Parts, Gerswock Trust and the Warwickshire Freemasons, while medical supplies were provided by the Ukraine Medical Charity. The Leamington History Group, Kenilworth Lions and Lifestyle Gift Cards donated hundreds of chocolate gifts. Bowden gave 5 boxes of new children's clothing, and the Rotary Club of Warwick also donated £500. A spokesperson for Belvedere said, "A heartfelt thank you goes to our volunteer drivers, who dedicated their time and effort to transport the ambulances." In Lejesk, eastern Poland, the drivers met with officers of the Ukrainian army, who received the vehicles and promptly set off for eastern Ukraine, where they will be used to save lives as quickly as possible. Belvedere said the deliveries would not have been possible without the incredible generosity and commitment of our partners, donors and volunteers. The organisation's projects include emergency aid deliveries, community food programmes and cultural initiatives that strengthen solidarity and understanding.
Giant sketches of an angel, used by the engraver John Hutton to create one of Coventry Cathedral's most striking features, have been repaired and gifted to the cathedral. Hutton produced chalk drawings on black paper as a blueprint for each of the 66 angel and saint figures, which he then took a decade to carve into the 70-foot-high glass west screen around the entrance to the cathedral. In 2022, the Friends of Coventry Cathedral bought the three sketches for £1,500, and about £20,000 has now been spent on specialist restoration. Cathedral archivist Diane Morris said she was so excited to see the finished art. "It's all my Christmases come at once. When they were offered to us for sale, I knew we had to get involved. They're so magnificent, I think I would have bought them myself anyway." The sketches consist of 3 7-feet by 3-feet images, which together make up a triptych of one of the flying angels depicted on the glass screen. They were created as the engraver worked on the screen, which was completed in time for the cathedral's consecration in 1962. "The carvings were created using an outline sketch of each of the figures," said Miss Morris, "and then the detail was created by a tool that he invented himself, comprising hand and dentist drills. Hutton's wife Marigold acted as his model for the figures," she said. "To be able to get an outline of the figures, John draped her in an old bedspread, while he quickly sketched the outline of the saints and angels. The triptych will be on display at the cathedral over the Christmas period." Specialist conservator Heather Norville Day said she was thrilled to be asked to carry out the restoration work. I can't tell you how honoured I am to do this. The prints were extremely brittle, water damaged, they had mould damage and a lot of fractures and missing areas, she explained. Over the last 50 years, pieces have dropped off and been lost. She worked on the sketches for about 6 months and said she now hoped they would last for 100 years or more. Sadly, it's thought that Hutton's life was cut short by inhaling quantities of glass dust, but his ashes are interred at the base of the screen. The artist's work can also be seen at Guildford Cathedral and at cathedrals in New Zealand, where Hutton was born. However, Martin Williams, chair of the Friends of Coventry Cathedral, insists that Coventry's are the best. The angels aren't just there being holy and pious, he said. He's depicted them as dancing and playing instruments and flying with movement.
Christmas has arrived in a Warwickshire village as its annual festive statue makeover is unveiled. The Lord John Scott statue in Dunchurch is furtively dressed for Christmas each year, in a tradition that dates back decades. Who decorates it is the village's best-kept secret, according to residents, despite plenty of speculation. This year it has transformed into German Shepherd pup Chase, a character from much-loved children's TV programme Paw Patrol, whose slogan is, "Chase is on the case." On the statue's plinth, a cardboard sign reads, "Chase is on the Christmas case." Amber Cummins, who lives in the village, said she was especially happy with the decoration, as Paw Patrol was her three-year-old son's favourite show. The anticipation builds as Christmas approaches, and the reveal never disappoints, she added. The dressed-up statue brings the community together, and it's heartwarming to see. In recent years, the sculpture has always been transformed into the likes of Bluey, Pinocchio, Pingu and Peppa Pig. It also became a World War II soldier in May to mark victory in Europe Day.
Coventry Airport will close next year to make way for a proposed battery manufacturing and technology hub. Operators the Rigby Group announced the site in Baginton would close in June to allow the next phase of work on Green Power Park, part of the planned Coventry and Warwick Gigapark. Tenants at the site have received a letter telling them they will have to leave by May the 9th. A £23 million funding package to support the first phase of development for Green Power Park, the installation of a dedicated energy supply capable of supporting large-scale battery production, was announced by the West Midlands Combined Authorities in January. The Rigby Group said that the closure of Coventry Airport would allow the next phase of infrastructure work to go ahead. Plans to build an access road, begin demolition and construct a 30-megawatt electrical substation were given the green light by Warwick District Council, which has jurisdiction over the site as it sits just outside the Coventry city boundary. Green Power Park is billed as a centre of excellence for electrification, battery technology and manufacturing. The location will be the first of its kind, aiming to provide a solution for battery research, industrialisation, manufacturing, testing, recycling and electrified logistics, designed to foster the UK's growing battery ecosystem. When fully developed, the Gigapark could create up to 6,000 jobs in battery manufacturing and in the EV supply chain. It's one of three key sites, alongside the Wolverhampton Green Innovation Corridor and Birmingham Knowledge Quarter, that will power the West Midlands Investment Zone. Councillor Jim O'Boyle, Coventry City's Council's spokesperson for jobs, regeneration and climate change, said that Green Power Park had an important role to play in accelerating the UK's transition to an electrified economy. He said, "Green Power Park will act as a catalyst for a fully integrated and globally competitive battery ecosystem at the heart of the United Kingdom. It forms key part of our ambitious plans to turn Coventry into an electric city, alongside projects such as Coventry Very Light Rail and our strategic energy partnership with E.ON. passenger flights from Coventry Airport ended in 2008, but it has been still used for business and freight flights.
An old cinema and a wartime anti-tank structure could be added to the city's list of heritage assets. The Astoria, which opened as the Broadway Cinema in Earlston in 1922, and the Blacker Bombard Spigot Mortar, next to the city's Oxford Canal, have been nominated for the City Council's local list of heritage assets. Councillor Naeem Akhtar, Cabinet Member for Housing and Communities, has been recommended to approve a period of public consultation to consider including the two locations on the list. Although not nationally designated, a local listing means the building's significance merits consideration in future planning decisions, a report says. Councillor Akhtar is to consider the report, which mentions the two sites, this week. Locally listed buildings are buildings and sites within the local planning authority's area, which make a positive contribution to its local character and sense of place because of their heritage value, the report says. The cinema, which is now home to the Nexus Institute of Creative Arts, was nominated by a member of the public. The council's archaeology officer put forward the Spigot Mortar, which is off Shilton Lane. A local listing designation does not restrict development of a site, but any application for redevelopment would need to evidence impact to it, and, where any loss is proposed, demonstrate that the benefits of a proposal outweigh the loss, the report explains. The cinema served as one of Coventry's main interwar entertainment venues, and is said to have reflected the growth of the cinema industry in the early 20th century. Although some decorative finishes have been removed or altered, its main structure and facade are among parts remaining largely intact. Meanwhile, the Blacker Bombard Spigot Mortar is part of a pair along the canal, the other outside the city boundary. It was among defence structures built from the summer of 1940 against the threat of German invasion. Coventry City Council's list has evolved over time since at least 1974, the report adds, as nominations have been put forward and considered. It includes the Calcot Cycle Works in Far Gosford Street and the Aardvark Pub, which was called the Hen and Chickens when it opened in the 1830s.
Motorists across Warwickshire are urged to be on their guard against a parking text scam. Fake phishing scam SMS text messages are being sent to residents across the county, pretending to be penalty charge notice payment requests. Warwickshire County Council says it does not send text messages about the payment of penalty charge notices and warns people not to click any links or to part with any personal information. Warwickshire County Council's transport spokesperson, Councillor Jennifer Warren, said, "We urge residents to stay alert to these scams. Never share your personal details for payment unless you are absolutely certain it's a trustworthy source. And if you receive a text about a penalty charge notice, delete it. It is definitely not from us." For clarification, penalty notices are issued by being placed on a vehicle's windscreen or are sent by post if this isn't possible. Genuine penalty charge notices from Warwickshire County Council always start with the code ZQ.
Coventry's bid to install a tram network across the city is set to take another step forward with the installation of a new track. A new 800-metre route running from Coventry Railway Station to Coventry University Technology Park is due to be installed by March 2027. The new route will be roughly four times the length of the premier demonstrator track installed in the city centre when testing started in May this year, 2025. Unlike the previous testing, this new route will operate in live traffic conditions and we will be connected to the city's traffic light control system in a bid to prove the safety and viability of the very light rail system. The hope is that a first fully functional commercial route will be operational by the end of 2027. Labour Councillor Jim O'Boyle said the tram network would be a game changer. He explained, "It will be good for the environment, have no unsightly overhead cables, and in the future it has the potential to be autonomous, offering a hop-on and hop-off service." The first full commercial route in the city could be between the railway station and the site of Coventry Airport, where there are plans to create a battery manufacturing centre. The ultimate aim is for a tram network to span the city, linking other areas like Anstey Park and Pool Meadow bus station. The new track will be delivered out of a £43.7 million budget allocated to the project to date, with most of the money provided by the Department for Transport via West Midlands Combined Authority, and a £3.2 million from Coventry City Council. The Conservative opposition leader in the city, Gary Ridley, has, however, previously questioned whether the money might be better off spent on bus services. Coventry City Council owns the intellectual property rights to the very light rail technology behind the tram system, technology which it says could allow small and medium-sized cities like Coventry develop tram networks at a fraction of the cost of traditional trams. The trams run on prefabricated slabs, meaning less groundwork is required and tracks can be installed more quickly without the need for overhead cables. By comparison, the 1 mile long East Side Metro extension in Birmingham has a budget of £245 million. Coventry City Council aims to demonstrate that VLR can be delivered at a cost of around £16 million per mile.
Photographs showing motor industry workers with some of the vehicles they helped build have been produced in a project to mark major World War II anniversaries. Dresden-based photographers Gunter and Christine Stark captured the dozens of former and current workers at Coventry Transport Museum, 85 years on from the Coventry Blitz and 80 years since the destruction of Dresden. The couple travelled to the city for a project which, they say, reflects Coventry's pivotal role as a centre of motor production. It's hoped that their work will be displayed in exhibitions in both Dresden and Coventry. Several retired workers posed with cars associated with their often decades-long careers. Brian Pollard was photographed standing next to a Hillman Imp, which he said held a place in my history and in my heart. He had worked on the model's engine as a production engineer at the Humber Car Company in the 1960s. It was an interesting but complicated project, he explained. It was new types of engineering that hadn't been done before because we were using aluminium, which was totally alien compared to all the iron that we'd ever used. We all enjoyed the work and we felt we were part of a massive development as far as the engineering side was concerned. Former Jaguar worker Ivor Lee said he remembered the last E-type Jag rolling off the production line in Coventry. Former Peugeot and Jaguar Land Rover worker Harbhajan Singh Pangli also took part in the project. The retiree, who is now trustee at the Gurdwara Guru Nanak Parkash in Coventry, said the city's car history should be promoted a lot more, and this project would again help put Coventry's motor industry on the map. The two cities share a link through their mutual devastation by World War II bombing, leading to a post-war twinning for peace and reconciliation. Gunter Stark made his name as a documentary photographer in the East German city under German Democratic Republic, while Christine is known for her portraits and photography since German reunification. The project was facilitated by the Coventry Association for International Friendship, which has helped develop and organise arts exchanges with Dresden for more than 10 years. Dave Hirons, Assistant Secretary, said the hope was for the photos to be exhibited in Coventry and in Dresden, which is home to its own transport museum.
A university student has become the youngest person to run 40 consecutive marathons. Angus Reid from Warwick took on his endurance challenge, which involves completing marathons in 40 different European countries in 4 months, to raise money for Cancer Research UK in memory of his aunt who died in 2014. He has raised more than £11,000 during his challenge, which he said was absolutely unbelievable. "I've enjoyed so much of it, Budapest and Nice being highlights, but there's some parts I also haven't enjoyed, like living out of a massive suitcase for 4 months," he said. The 22-year-old said that he had twice run the Leeds Marathon beforehand, but did little in terms of preparation for the challenge. "You've just kind of got to throw yourself into the deep end and then figure it out as you go along," he said. His travels included running along the coast of Monaco and in sub-zero Icelandic temperatures, as he ticked off 40 of the 44 UN-recognised European countries, averaging one marathon every 3 days. He started 4 months ago when the temperature was 30 degrees and ended when he completed his challenge on Saturday in London. After completing a law degree at Leeds University, Mr. Reid said he was looking to do something before going into full-time work. "Originally, I just wanted to do some solo travelling around Eastern Europe," he said, "but then concocted a challenge to give himself something to aim for when I was travelling. I've been to so many countries that I wasn't planning on going to originally, such as Tallinn in Estonia. That was a beautiful city. I really enjoyed Sarajevo in Bosnia-Herzegovina. My favourite run was Nice to Monaco along the south coast of France. That was stunning. A really sunny day with beautiful coastline." Mr. Reid ran a marathon on average every 3 days and said while some were on planned circuits, others were made up as they went along, using the Strava app. His final marathon ended at Cliff Park in Stoke Newington, London, last Saturday. "When I finished the challenge, my body kind of shut down in a way," he said. "I had to go to A&E. And I got diagnosed with severe fatigue / exhaustion, really, from the whole trip. 5 friends accompanied him on the final run, and he said that they really helped me push through."
A Sikh temple in Warwickshire is set to hand out more than 2,000 food parcels and festive hampers to families in need. The Gurdwara Baba Vadbag Singh Ji Trust in Bedworth has been running its Christmas project since 2019. Trustee Gurdeep Kaur Sarah said, "Last year we were able to assist 9 schools. This year the project has expanded so much we're now collaborating with 25 schools. Every hamper includes a £10 shopping voucher and a week's worth of food. The hampers are packed and delivered by volunteers as well as by members of the local community." The Gurdwara's Christmas project started as early as September this year, when the congregation was asked to make donations in the form of money or goods for the hampers. "I've lost count of the number of packages we're now providing because the numbers have grown massively since 2019, Miss Sarah said. "It's just exploded and it's become a real community event. The founder of the establishment, Babaji, says, if you make a child happy, you make God happy. And here we're touching on so many families and children that are just going to have smiles on their faces."
This Christmas, Aldi is looking to put one of the most divisive culinary conundrums of Christmas to bed, once and for all, after creating a new cocktail that will settle the debate on whether we love or loathe the Brussels sprout. Sprout Nog, developed by the supermarket, turns the humble vegetable into a seasonal standout. While most pair the delicacy with pancetta or walnuts, this cocktail explores smooth winter flavour profiles such as cream, cinnamon and cloves to create a unique tipple bound to get the party guests talking or speechless. But it hasn't hit the shelves yet. Aldi is seeking a final stamp of approval from the public in a sproutocracy vote to see if there is really an appetite for the aperitif to join its canned cocktail range. It comes as new research reveals how Brits plan to serve their sprouts this Christmas, as over half the country consider themselves devout sprout lovers. Well, only just over half, at 56%. With nearly half of Brits, 46%, saying that they are likely to experiment with the vegetable this Christmas, the development of the cocktail marks a trend in which Brits are becoming more adventurous in their attempt to elevate the sprout. According to the Sproutometer, Aldi's regional sprout ranking system, residents of Gloucester top the table as the city with the wildest tastes in Brussels, with 45% most likely to add pancetta, 23% chestnuts, and a remarkable 31% a drizzle of maple syrup. Or there again, how about all three? In Cambridge, residents are taking it to a new level, as 15% admit to enjoying the dish with a touch of chocolate. 55% of those in Blackpool dress up the vegetable in hot honey, and in Bradford, 26% spice things up with chilli flakes. Julie Ashfield, Chief Commercial Officer at Aldi UK, said, "Whether you love them or loathe them, sprouts are a staple on Christmas tables across the UK. So it's great to see that Brits are planning to embrace their culinary creativity and explore new recipes and flavour pairings. With shoppers experimenting this year, we were inspired to do the same. Our newly developed Sprout Nog offers a truly unique way of enjoying the Christmas vegetable, and we're calling on shoppers to determine the future of this cocktail creation. So head over to our Instagram and Facebook pages to have your say." However, the study of 2,000 UK adults also revealed that Brits are keeping it simple elsewhere, as 33% still prefer their sprouts simply boiled with a pinch of salt, particularly in Bath, Cardiff and Swansea. But do you like your sprout then with a bit of bite to it, or do you like it soft and soggy?
Leamington-born boxer Lewis Williams has smashed his fundraising target for the Mighton Hospices, which cared for his father. Lewis has exceeded his £20,000 target, raising an impressive £20,823 to support the charity's vital services. Lewis joined Team Mighton earlier this year as a volunteer ambassador, following the care that his dad, Bob, received from the Hospices' Mighton at Home team. Lewis, inspired by the support his family received, pledged to raise money for Mighton throughout his boxing career, beginning with his 20 in 25 campaign, setting out to raise £20,000 in his first year as ambassador. Lewis said, "I'm absolutely blown away by the support. To think we've smashed the target within 8 months is incredible. It's all done to amazing support from so many people." Ruth Freeman, CEO at the Mighton Hospices, said, "We'd like to give a huge thank you to Lewis and everyone who supported his campaign. We rely on the generosity of our community to provide our vital services to people who desperately need our care, and we couldn't do it without people like Lewis." The fundraiser that took Lewis over the £20,000 target was Together We Dance event, an evening of disco, family games and a live auction organised by his sister, Sophie, and his mother. The event attracted nearly 100 guests and raised over £6,000. Highlights included the sale of Lewis's boxing gloves from his 2022 Commonwealth Games gold medal fight and a Guess the Total competition with tickets to his next fight as the prize. An auction at the NEC had raised over £3,000, where a pair of signed Frank Bruno boxing gloves sold for nearly £500. Lexus also made a generous contribution of £1,750 through the Toyota Community Fund. Lewis rallied support for Walk for Mighton, entering a team that raised over £5,000, and he was joined on that day by young members of Cleary's Gym and their families. Lewis remains determined to raise as much as possible in the remaining months of his 20 and 25 campaign, ensuring that even more people can access the care and support they need.
And the final news item for 2025 just has to have a happy ending. An unwanted dog who spent years at a rescue centre has finally found a home. When Moose arrived at Dogs Trust Kenilworth in October 2021, the team was hopeful he would be rehomed quickly. But the big crossbreed didn't have much luck, with several adoptions falling through. Likely not helped as his formative years were spent during lockdown, which, according to the Trust, meant he missed out on vital social experiences that help young dogs grow in confidence. This left him anxious and struggling to manage his big dog energy. So the Dogs Trust Kenilworth team created a bespoke training plan to help Moose build confidence and learn the life skills needed to thrive. This included helping him settle in new environments, relax around people, and feel safe when his food and toys were handled. And then enter Matthew and Alina, experienced dog owners who were open to a dog needing a special home. The three of them fell in love instantly, but on the advice of the Dogs Trust team, waited for Moose to complete more training before starting the process of building a relationship. Now Moose, who had to wait 1,256 days, is getting ready to spend Christmas in a happy place with Matthew and Alina. Matthew said, "We felt drawn to Moose right away. He was the big dog we wanted. And although he did have some behavioural issues, he was super playful, loved his treats and any attention he could get. After a couple of meetings, we felt that, given enough time, he could blossom into a confident dog and his playful personality could come out. In the time he has been with us, Moose is already a completely different dog from when we first brought him home. We know he's on the right path to being the most confident boy he can be." Emma Jane Thomas, manager at Dogs Trust Kenilworth, said, "After such a long time with us, Moose's story isn't one we're likely to forget. During his time here, the team worked hard to help this gentle giant feel confident, and the rehoming story is an excellent example of how the right care and training in the right place can help a dog find its forever home. Every dog deserves to be in their happy place, in their forever home, and we all wish Moose a pawsome Christmas."
Outlook News.
Thanks to our readers, Peter and Elaine. I do like a sprout myself, but I like them in traditional ways, not messed about with. Mm. Anyway, before we move on, I've just got the lighting up times for this week, which are from 3:56 p.m. to 8 a.m. And now for something new, or fairly new anyway. Rowan is our new volunteer, and she's going to tell us about local entertainment for the next couple of weeks. Rowan, over to you.
Thank you. It's the final countdown to the holiday season, and as we start to wind down ourselves, here's a roundup for what's coming up. Panto season is in full swing. Oh, yes, it is. Across almost every theatre in the Midlands. But on our doorstep, we have Sleeping Beauty, which continues to run at the Belgrade Theatre to rave reviews. The run finishes on the 3rd of Jan with a relaxed and captioned performance for those who need it on the 2nd of January at 2 p.m. Open at the Albany Theatre, Beauty and the Beast is this year's Christmas show for those who struggle with a sometimes overwhelming atmosphere of a traditional pantomime. This dazzling alternative is packed with magic, excitement and just the right amount of festive sparkle. This production closes on the 4th of January with booking available online and over the phone. Robinson Crusoe has almost arrived at the Talisman Theatre in Kenilworth. When Robinson and his brother find a treasure map, there's nothing for it but to set off in search of their fortune on a faraway island. Opening on the 20th of December and closing on the 3rd of January with a relaxed performance for its final matinee. The Priory Theatre brings in the famous Three Bears and Porridge for its 2025 panto Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Watch as the glorious Goldilocks embarks on an adventure with the adorable Three Bears, perfect for a festive outing. The production opens on the 17th, which is the day we are recording, and closes on the 4th of January. The majority of these performances have sold out, but there is a waiting list for those hoping to book. Further into Leamington, Peter Pan flies into the Spa Centre opening on the 20th of December. When Wendy and her brothers encounter the mysterious Peter, the boy who never grows old, they are whisked off to the magical island of Neverland. With the island under threat, can they help Peter and the Lost Boys defeat the villainous Captain Hook and his infamous pirate crew? Peter flies back to Neverland on the 4th of January, so get those tickets booked. The Three Spires Guildhall presents Cinderella, a magical pantomime packed with laughter, music and sparkle. With a hilarious script, dazzling sets and an incredible cast, this captivating production promises fun for all ages. Cinderella marks the last panto of the season, opening on the 8th of January and closing on the 11th, with a relaxed performance on the 11th at 12:30pm. In other news, the Criterion Theatre rebuild has officially opened for its first coffee morning last week, and they will continue every month from January. A familiarisation tour of the new layout should be in the new year, so stay tuned, before their first production of The Who's Tommy in February. For those into their telly, the Strictly Come Dancing final airs on the 20th of December this Saturday, with audio description available on BBC iPlayer. Who's in your books to win? Amber, Karen or George? Now, heading into Christmas Day, the schedules have just been released, and here are your highlights across all channels. The BBC One Christmas Morning airs at 10am this year, Matilda the Musical at 1pm, with the King's Speech bang on 3pm. 3:35, The Gladiators arrive, and at 5:30pm, the Strictly Christmas Special arrives, and for those keeping track, this is the last time Tess and Claudia will present the show. EastEnders Part 1 airs at 7:45pm, with Part 2 airing at 9:45pm. On BBC Two, The Nutcracker Ballet is on at 11:25am, White Christmas 1954 straight after at 1pm. On ITV, Emmerdale airs at 6:15pm, with Coronation Street live after at 7:15pm. That's all the soaps out the way. Lastly, on Channel 4, the alternative Christmas Message airs at 5:20pm and the Christmas Bake Off airs at 7:40pm. And that's everything I have today, and just want to wish you an amazing holiday season, whatever you celebrate, and if you don't, have a great 2 weeks. We'll see you in January.
Thank you very much, Rowan, for that. Moving on, the person sitting next to me, Hugh, has got a massive bucket in his hand because we're going to do the live raffle draw, I think, Hugh. Over to you.
Yes, we are. Hello, everybody. At long last, we're at the our Christmas raffle. We started that at the Winter Warmer, and we've had a really good response to it. So thank you, everybody who bought a ticket. And we're looking forward, actually, to finding out who the winners are. So I've got Elaine, Pete and Ro in the studio, and they are going to be drawing the tickets.
Ooh.
So here we go. We've got six prizes, and the first prize is the enormous Christmas hamper that has been sitting in reception. So if you win, I will be bringing it to you. In fact, if you win any of these prizes, I will try and bring them to you before we go off on holiday. So here we go. Elaine.
Well, Pete is the most senior member.
Oh, all right. Apparently Pete is the most senior member, and he gets to choose the first
one. All right, just one.
Yeah, just one. So this is for the Christmas hamper. And the winner is... Oh, I can't read that. Win Lang. Okay, so
I know Win Lang.
You know Win Lang. Good. All right. Well, congratulations to Win Lang. She's she's won that absolutely massive hamper. So we will be getting in contact with her a bit later today. The next is a family ticket for the Coventry Blaze. This is being drawn by Elaine, and the winner of that one is Sarah Headley. Sarah is our craft group volunteer, so congratulations to Sarah. That'll be a nice easy one, because as we're recording, she's in the Mary Beale room, so that's nice and easy. Okay, Ro, here we go. So this is for a family ticket for Coventry Rugby.
Got one right from the bottom.
Right from the bottom, that's good. That's what we like. Everybody gets a chance. And that's Alison Manning. Now, we know Alison.
I know Alison.
Yeah, she's a long-standing volunteer on Echo as well, amongst many other things in the community. So she'll be very pleased with that, I'm sure. Next, we've got a lovely... It's currently on Elaine's desk. We've got a lovely bottle of Tam na Vuolin Scotch whisky. And here we go. And this one is... Margaret Knight. Well, congratulations, Margaret. Margaret is a service user here at the centre, so congratulations to her. Who's next? Yes, here we go. There we are. Fifth prize is a bottle of Prosecco, which is right in front of me. And that goes to Angela Horton. So congratulations to Angela. We've got her... her number on there as well. And Rowan, you get to draw the last one, which is a box of Belgian chocolate liqueurs, which is very nice indeed.
Another one from the bottom for good measure.
Another one from the bottom for good measure. Here we go. Kath. Well, it just says Kath on there. I think I know which Kath that is. That might be Kath, Kath who comes to the centre on a Tuesday. I think she'll be very pleased with those. Not that I'm casting any asparagus at her. So, so congratulations to all our winners. We will be making sure that they get hold of their prizes before Christmas so that they can enjoy them over the festive season. Apart from that, I do not have much to say, except that we've had an awful lot of changes over the year, not least a change in our name. We went from Coventry Resource Centre for the Blind to Coventry Vision Hub in July. I'm pleased to say that that changeover has gone extremely well, and we've had a lot of very, very positive responses to that since we first announced it and then put it into practice in July. Thank you to everybody who remembers to call us by the new name. Carry on doing that. It does make a difference to people. We've had a lot more people come through the door for us because they've felt that it's a bit more inclusive and that we can support them. We now have well over 500 people on our books of people who come to us for support as they need to. We also have an enormous number of volunteers now. We've got something like over 100 volunteers of people who come in and help us in all aspects of the charity. So it's wonderful to have so much support. As staff here, we could not do anything here without the support of our terrific volunteers, and our heartfelt thanks go out to them every year. We'll be celebrating them end of January, when we've got a fantastic volunteers party arranged to celebrate them. There'll be lots of lovely food and a fun night to be had by all. We're buying our new minibus as well, so that you will see very early in the new year. So that will be coming to us, I think it's the end of the first week of January, or halfway through the first week of January. We'll be doing lots of fun stuff to promote that. We were talking about this in our staff meeting yesterday, about whether we where we might do one of those videos where you've got a whole bunch of people coming off the bus. You know, you've got hundreds of people coming off the bus because they're going around the back and getting on the buggy. So we're gonna have a bit of fun promoting that. But we're looking forward to that lovely new bus, and we're trying to see whether we can have a third bus, so we might have three buses in operation. Which, you know, given how busy we are at the moment, would be very useful. Now, as you know, we are closing now for 2 weeks. I think the Talking Newspaper is off for 2 weeks, and as indeed is, and the Vision Hub will be closed for these 2 weeks from Monday the 22nd all the way, and we reopen again on Monday the 5th.
The staff here have worked so hard this year. I cannot tell you how hard everybody has worked. And we felt that given the way the dates fall, that we absolutely needed to have a good couple of weeks of downtime. And so thank you all for your understanding. It very much needed because, you know, although we have all our volunteers and everything, we still rely on our pretty small staff team to be able to achieve so many of the things we do. So it only remains for me to say thank you so much to you all, to wish you a very Merry Christmas and a very Happy New Year, and we will be back with you in January.
Thank you, Hugh, and I think a vote of gratitude is due to you as well, for leading the organisation, which seems to be going from strength to strength.
It's certainly busy.
Yes, to a great 2026.
Thank you.
We don't have sport this week. Sarah's not been able to do it, but she hopes to cover the Sports Personality of the Year contest later in the week. Here's Dave Monks with Postbag.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello there, and welcome to your postbag, and a very happy Christmas to you. We begin with some useful information about Christmas bus services from National Express. Here's Graham Whale.
I thought I'd say just a few words about the arrangements for the bus services over the Christmas period, at least National Express anyway. Don't think it could be a bit too late for this before this Christmas, but it's basically the same as this last few years, and I suspect it'll be the same as next year. So, in simple terms, there'll be no buses on Christmas Day. On Boxing Day and New Year's Day, it will be a Sunday service up to around 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening. And apart from Saturdays and Sundays in between, it will be a normal Saturday and Sunday service. From the Monday before Christmas to the Friday after Christmas, or Saturday should I say, it will be an amended Saturday service. Amended because they will try and operate some sort of service to the industrial areas such as the 13A, 18A, 21A. But basically it will be a Saturday service throughout that period, apart from Christmas Day of course. Boxing Day and New Year's Day. That's National Express. I have no idea what Stagecoach are doing. They tend to go to bed for a few days. They're just idle.
Thank you, Graham, for all the useful information that you've sent into Postbag throughout the year, in fact, the years. And now is a Christmas greeting from folk singer Lauren South to Amy Clunnell, followed by a Christmas greeting from Edwina.
Hello, Amy. It's Lauren South here. I met you at Lighthorn Folk Club, I think, a little while ago. Just sending you a really Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and hope to see you again really soon. Lots of love. Bye.
Hi, everybody. Have a very Merry Christmas, and I hope a happier New Year. Take care, everybody. I'll be thinking of you. Bye.
Thank you very much, Edwina, for all the pieces you've done. So I hope you'll be back soon. Anyway, here's Bob Syme with a Christmas message, first of all, for me.
Hello, Dave. It's Bob Syme here. Just to wish you all the best for the new year coming. And I hope you have good health all the time. It's very good at all the hard work that you do. I know what work you do besides just reading out things on the Outlook. Because I've been involved with that all right from day one, but you've been there for years as well. So take good care, and all the listeners, take good care of yourselves. Have a wonderful Christmas and a new year. Bob Syme.
Thank you, Bob. Your message to me is much appreciated. I do spend a lot of time on Outlook, and also so does Christine as well, with her engineering. and I think John does as well. Now, have you been to any Christmas parties? Elizabeth's been to one with the Nostalgics. Here she is to talk about it.
I feel I must comment on an absolutely fabulous afternoon, which I enjoyed this week. I went to the Nostalgics Christmas Bash in Carrington. The Christmas dinner was lovely, and there was dancing all afternoon. What an accomplishment. Many thanks.
Thank you, Elizabeth. A member of the Nostalgics called Joyce organised the meal and party. Now, Janet, who you kindly gave advice to regarding her sight problem, said you were a lovely person. Elizabeth also would like to thank Judith for being so helpful and caring, and so would I. Since Sheila died, seeing that I seemed a bit lost, she started inviting me to outings with the Macular Support Group. And Judith of the Macular Support Group wishes everyone a happy Christmas. Graham and I have been going to the Frankfurt Birmingham Christmas Market quite a few times to listen to the German singers. Here's Graham talking about the origin of jingle bells, and then we're going to hear the singer Carmen speaking to you.
What have you found out on your phone, Graham?
Jingle bells are originally called One Horse Open Sleigh, and it's a drinking song.
Yep, okay.
That's right, isn't it?
Sounds about right.
Jingle Bells is one of the first songs to be broadcasted from space.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow! A Christmas broadcast. Great. Can you, do you have a Christmas greeting for the listeners of Coventry Talking Newspaper for the visually impaired, please?
I wish everyone a merry, merry Christmas. Enjoy the time. Find family. Maybe it's not the direct family, but maybe it's friend that feels like family. So, yeah, have warm hearts for all this cold season of the year.
And now, here's some greetings from the Monday Club, starting with a big greeting from everybody, followed by Peggy and Hilda.
1, 2, 3.
Happy Christmas from the Monday Club to everybody.
Would you like to wish Happy Christmas to all everybody?
Yes.
Happy Christmas, everybody.
And Hilda.
Happy Christmas to everybody. The Monday Club and the Writing Club and everybody else.
Yeah. Thank you very much, both of you. That's lovely.
So let me say Happy Christmas to all our listeners out there, to the community, to our friends, and I wish you a very Merry Christmas and a happy, happy, happy New Year. So I wish you a Merry, Merry Christmas and a happy, happy, happy New Year.
Hi everyone. This week's roving report comes from the Belgrade Theatre, where we had the Macular Support Group's Christmas Bash. A wonderful Christmas lunch was followed by the pantomime Sleeping Beauty. Judith and Georgina really did work their socks off. An excellent choice of venue. Many thanks, girls. You did us proud, as always. Merry Christmas and love to all.
Thank you, Elizabeth, and let us know if you've been to any pantos. And now, here's Doreen and Elizabeth with their Christmas wishes, followed by a joke from Robert Franklin.
Hello, everybody, again. This is Doreen Hilton speaking to you all again. As we know, another year getting on, it is Christmas. And it is nice to say for the Resource Centre, for the staff, the CVS, all our volunteers who help through, who bring us backwards and forwards to the centre, take us home, make sure we're fine. They really need a very, very good Christmas. Especially our Dave, I will say for our Dave, he's helped me a tremendous lot to come and speak on the CVS. He helps me very, very well, and I thank him. And also, I thank the staff who have helped me all through the year. And you do deserve a very, very nice Christmas and a prosperous new year. But what they do say, though you're having that, keep yourself warm, well, keep the fergie away from you. So I say to you all, through the Resource Centre, the staff, the volunteers, the CVS, especially our postman Dave, a very, very happy new year and a prosperous one. I'll see you all in the year. God bless, Doreen Hilton. Bye.
With Christmas fast approaching, I would like to take this opportunity to thank everyone for the help, the love and the kindness shown to me over the past year. Especially Karen, Carl and Peter Huxford. Love to Isabel for her help and kindness too. A very happy and healthy Christmas to you all.
Why did Santa have three allotments? Because he wanted to go ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho. Thank you very much, Robert, and for your helpful tips. You have told me to pass on to the listeners throughout the year. Much appreciated. And also your talk at the Monday Club. Look forward to seeing you again in January, hopefully. And I'd like to finish with my granddad's poem from 1881. That's 144 years ago. He recited this poem when he was carol singing door to door. It was written by his dad. I wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, friends without number and lots of good cheer, and may you be happy throughout the new year. God bless the master of this house, and the mistress also. Likewise, little children, may they no sorrow know, and may every one within this house, may every blessing flow, and boys and girls meet cheerily beneath the mistletoe. I wish you may have gladness around your Christmas fire. I wish you may have happiness and all that you desire. I wish you may have plenty of everything in store. But don't forget the little boy now standing at your door. Merry Christmas to you and a Happy New Year. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's all we have from Postbag for this week. This week, our Warwickshire wanderings take us to the village of Polesworth, close to the border with Staffordshire. In modern times, the area became associated with coal mining. But back in the 16th century, it was the focus of an important literary circle that included the poet Michael Drayton and the playwright Ben Jonson.
Polesworth is a large village at the tip of North Warwickshire, bordering on Staffordshire and Leicestershire. And to reach it, one has to cross a bridge of some kind. There are two railways, three canals, and a wide bridge over the River Anker. From the river bridge, looking eastwards, one can see the beautiful Abbey Church and Vicarage. The accepted date of the Abbey is AD 827. Polesworth got its name from Pole, meaning deep water, and Worth, being a dwelling. It is a place steeped in history. William Shakespeare and Michael Drayton, the poet, were purported to be visitors to Pooley Hall and the vicarage. Pooley Hall is an ancient manor house with chapel, overlooking the river and gardens. Thomas Kirkcain, who built the hall in 1507, was slain on his way to church by his feuding neighbour, Thomas Burdett from Bramcote Hall. A true but sorry tale. Among the ancient buildings remaining is a tithe barn, beautifully restored, and now a very useful amenity for the village. There are a few cottages, a dovecot, the Nethersole Centre, which was originally a school, and the Nunnery Gateway, which is the entranceway to the church. Yes, long ago there were nuns in Polesworth, and they taught needlework to the girls of the village. In the 17th century, Sir Francis Nethersole had founded a school so that boys and girls could have a free education. The lovely thatched house in the square, which was once a landmark, the flour mill by the river, and Little Jim's cottage have long since gone, but there is a poem in print about Little Jim, the collier's son. Polesworth was one of the first villages to have electricity, a luxury indeed, if only for lighting. It was generated at Pooley Hall Colliery. The colliery was acquired by a New Zealand family named Shater, who had also purchased Pooley Hall with its lands in the late 1800s. In the lawn field near the colliery, where there is a monument to the colliers who gave their lives in the First World War, an annual gymkhana used to be held, and hundreds of people enjoyed this special day. The pit ponies enjoyed it too, because they came up for an airing and a welcome graze. The canal winds its way through Polesworth, and years ago, the local firm of Lees and Atkins built and repaired narrowboats at Polesworth Docks. A family member painted them with lovely roses and castles. The winters long ago were very severe, and most people could skate. They would skate by moonlight on the frozen canal, and if there was no moon, they lit candles and placed them on either side. Villagers formed their own concert party and Morris dancing troupe, and there seemed to be as many pubs as villagers. In fact, there is only one less pub today, and the population now is approximately 8,000. In 1912, a cinema was opened in a converted flour mill. This delighted the villagers, who enjoyed the serial films which were included. On Saturday afternoon, there was a children's matinee with comedies and westerns. Private apartments have now been built on the site near to the canal, where the cinema used to be. With the closure of the colliery and the clay works, which had chimneys that belched out the most dreadful smoke and sulphur fumes, most workers today have to commute to nearby towns and cities. However, now that the M42 has been built, a section of which runs through the parish, life has become easier for commuters. In a lovely setting near the river and church is the park, a legacy one could say from the Second World War. During that time, Park Farm was commandeered for open-cast coal mining, and afterwards the site was transformed into a park for the people of Polesworth.
Deck the halls with boughs of holly is a well-known line from a popular Christmas carol, but in fact many of our favourite carols have nothing to do with Christmas, says composer, conductor and author Andrew Gant, who explains all in a Daily Express article read by Sue.
Nothing sends a shiver up the spine at this time of year like the sound of a well-drilled choir performing Silent Night or Away in a Manger. There's something deeply moving about the tradition of Christmas carols, whether in church or out. But what are they actually about? Quite often, as it turns out, not Christmas. How many times does our friend Good King Wenceslas mention the Nativity as he tramps about his territory cooking dinner for strangers? Not once. Indeed, many carols have ties to seasonal folk traditions rather than the biblical narrative. There may be lots of holly and ivy songs, but they describe new life in the depths of winter, not church or religion. And many of our best-loved songs mix together items from different places, such as O Little Town of Bethlehem, whose original words were written by the 19th century US bishop Philip Brooks. He lived through the American Civil War and gave the oration at the funeral of assassinated President Abraham Lincoln. That same year, he journeyed to the Holy Land and recorded a visit to the old church in Bethlehem, close to Jesus' birthplace, in his diary. Hearing hymns of praise to God, he wrote that it seemed as if I could hear voices I knew well telling each other of the wonderful night of the Saviour's birth. Upon his return, he wrote a poem commemorating that moment of peace, beginning, O little town of Bethlehem, how still we see thee lie. It was set to music by his church organist, Louis Redner, back home in Philadelphia, and this tune, St. Louis, is still sung in America today. But English carol singers use a melody with a very different story to tell. Brooks published A Little Town of Bethlehem in 1891. In 1903, a decade after his death, it was included in Christmas songs and Easter carols. That same year, the great English composer Ralph Vaughan Williams found himself in the leafy lanes of Forest Green, Surrey, scribbling furiously as a knobbly old villager, one Mr. Garman, sang to him a folk ballad called The Ploughboy's Dream. In it, the ploughboy wickedly mistreats his oxen until he gets carried off to hell by a genie who appears from underground in a puff of blue smoke. The tune is sturdy and strong, nice and easy to sing too, and Vaughan Williams remembered these qualities when he undertook the job of musical editor of the New English Hymnal, published in 1906. For O Little Town of Bethlehem, he turned to the tune he had rechristened Forest Green, after the village where he had first heard it sung. Quite a few of our carols celebrate the existence of many different national and cultural influences in English life. Which of our favourite carols was known for much of its history as the Portuguese carol? It's O Come All Ye Faithful, despite it having nothing to do with Portugal. The name probably comes from it being sung for the first time in England in the Catholic chapels of the embassies of various European countries, including the Portuguese embassy, which boasted particularly good music. The festive hymn was also attributed for a long time to Handel, but that's not true either. Actually, it was first written down by John Francis Wade, an English Catholic exiled to France in the middle of the 18th century. It used to be sung in a jaunty three-in-a-bar time, much jollier than the rather stodgy march-like version we sing today. And it was in Latin, of course. The mid-19th century has, to a large extent, given us Christmas as we know it today. This has a lot to do with hymn writers such as John Mason Neale and Thomas Helmore, who dug up legends and melodies across history and continents to give us many of our best-loved songs, including Good King Wenceslas. The Victorians also gave us the magical imagery of goodwill and fireside warmth conjured so evocatively by Dickens in A Christmas Carol and other stories. They blessed us with the Christmas tree too, an import from Austria, along with songs like O Tannenbaum and Silent Night. Many other English Christmas carols are very far from being entirely English too. Take Deck the Halls, which started life as a Welsh love song. Even the familiar English words were written by Scotsman Thomas Oliphant. And even now, that jaunty favourite is nothing more than a New Year party song with no mention of God or church, angels or babies. And why not? Several of our favourite carols are American in origin, including We Three Kings, It Came Upon the Midnight Clear, and Away in a Manger. Away in a Manger is one of several items you'll hear sung to different tunes in the UK and America to this day. So too, It Came Upon the Midnight Clear, with words by an American Unitarian minister, Edmund Hamilton Sears. As with O Little Town, Sears had his poems set to music by an organist friend of his, Edward Storrs Willis, and this is the version still sung today in America. On this side of the Atlantic, we sing a different tune, an English folk song, borrowed by a composer moonlighting as editor of a carol book, in this case Arthur Sullivan of Gilbert and Sullivan fame. These differences do have their comical moments. Try taking an American cousin to an English carol service, as I did last year. Wait for the moment the service sheet announces we are about to sing It Came Upon the Midnight Clear, or O Little Town of Bethlehem, followed by the organ's introduction. Then wait for your cousin to turn to you with a puzzled and pained expression and mutter, "That's not the right tune." She's right, it's not. But it is our tune. The history of English carols doesn't go in a straight line, and it's much richer for it. Even the word carol has had many different associations over the centuries. Shakespeare describes a pair of young lovers. "This carol they began that hour, how that life was but a flower." The carol sung by this lover and his lass is a springtime love song, nothing to do with Christmas, still less church. Even in a sacred context, the carol was never exclusively a Christmas song. Many collections include Easter carols too. And of course, much of the most familiar imagery has nothing to do with the gospel story, including the ox and the ass, the frost and the snow, and all the mysterious imagery of folk carols. Why are there three ships and two passengers? Why do they sail into Bethlehem, which is landlocked, nowhere near a river, and doesn't have a port? And how did the partridge get up the pear tree? Nobody knows, but it can be a lot of fun guessing. Above all, enjoy singing once again this rich, wonderful repertoire of songs from all over every bit of our history. They are part of what makes us what we are, and they summon up a special kind of magic, like the smell of mince pies. Happy Christmas.
Singer Nick Golden was a guest entertainer at the Monday Club recently and revealed the musical and dancing past of member Veretta. Dave Monks reports.
Right, hello there. I'm speaking to you from the Coventry Vision Hub on a Monday morning, and Nick Golden's here. Hello, Nick, and you're about to entertain the Monday Club.
Well, okay. Good morning, David. Yes, I'm looking forward to it. This is actually my fourth visit.
Excellent.
And a lot has changed since I was last here.
Yeah.
I've been producing my own dance numbers, which has been going down really well.
Excellent.
And I think you heard one of them in the morning, Down by the Riverside.
Down by the Riverside. Yeah, I like that.
Because what I do is I take the numbers from 40s and before.
Yeah.
And I give them their own dance beat, and I give them the sound of the big band from the 40s.
Well, that's fantastic.
it's taken me a while, it's taken me a few years, but it's been going down really well. So I'm looking forward to giving everybody a great experience.
You have a very small keyboard. It's only about 2 foot long at the most, isn't it?
Yes.
And it sounds brilliant.
Well, it's quite an amazing little object, really. And I chose it because I can set it up in about 5 minutes and I've been able to make it wireless. And that means anybody that wants to go, I can take it over to them and they can have a go.
Yeah.
And it's ideal for clubs and retirement places where I've got to be set up quick and out quick. I do have a larger organ for, you know, different types of shows.
Yeah.
But it's very hard to tell the difference between my big organ, which costs a lot of money, and my little one.
Okay, you entertain at retirement homes, don't you? So you must get a lot of satisfaction out of that.
I often go in places and I can see sometimes certain people have had a hard week and they're really ready for a little bit of entertainment.
Yeah.
And I do try to move around the room, try to interact with everybody, so it's not just 12, 15 numbers that are rung off. I interact and it's a full show.
Speaking to Peggy, so what do you think of the morning?
I enjoyed it very much. We were all dancing, me in my chair, but it was Veretta. I couldn't take my eyes off Veretta. She was playing the piano on the table, and she'd gone. She was back in the 1950s, and it was fantastic.
I'm speaking to a member of the Monday Club, Veretta. I understand you've got a musical background. You used to teach music, you play the piano.
Well, I played the piano when I was little.
Yeah.
And then when I grew up, I did teaching jiving. I got bronze and silver in my ballroom. And that's where I met my husband, you see.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah,
he said, oh, will you teach me?
Yeah.
And down in the centre ballroom. Do you remember the centre ballroom?
I don't know. Which one was that?
Holyhead Road.
Standing Holyhead Road. Yeah, there was a ballroom there, yeah.
Yeah. And of course, it's gone now.
One of my favourite songs, I do with the organ, but not with the organ, is the Red River Rock. And this inspired me to do my own version. And it's a good one to dance to. This is my own version of the Red River Valley. It's my big dance version. Here we go.
Speaking to Eunice, so what do you think of your first morning at the Monday Club, Eunice?
I quite enjoyed it actually, quite nice, chatty, yes.
And it was nice to see you get up and dance and, well, dance with me. Wonderful.
Oh yeah, I like to have a boogie.
Can I ask you, Hilda, what you thought of the morning?
It was very bright and cheerful, very nice. Yeah,
yeah, it was great. Yeah, that's nice, having a bit of music.
We all enjoyed it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, we could all join in.
Thank you, Hilda. Nice to see you doing so well. Thank you.
Rock a bit on your chair.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant. You are my sunshine. My only sunshine. You make me happy. Words with Nick Golden. So did you enjoy singing at the Monday Club, Nick?
Did you enjoy me, everybody?
Yay! Fantastic. Yeah.
That's your answer.
That's your answer. Okay, thank you, Nick, for coming along and entertaining at the Monday Club. It's been fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, and that's another great morning over at the Monday Club, this time with Nick Golden. Bye for now.
We've already heard about Deck the Halls in this week's programme, and in part two of our Spirit of Christmas feature, Amanda Hodge, writing in This England magazine, explores another carol, God Bless Us Everyone. This is read by Elaine.
Written in just 6 weeks and published in December 1843, Dickens made the novella a personal project. By the 24th of October, he had fine artist John Leech at hand to work on illustrations, and by November, he was discussing the cover and advertising with his closest friend and future biographer, Forster. He insisted on fine coloured binding and end papers, striking gold lettering on the book's front and spine, and was determined it should be an easily affordable title, so priced it at just 5 shillings. The book's name, with its 5 sections divided into staves, are reminiscent of a musical composition and reflected Dickens's wish that this novella must be something enjoyed by families everywhere. He passionately wanted the novella to make affluent people realise that they were directly responsible for the poor folk they passed on the streets. All humans are fellow passengers to the grave, as Fred Scrooge's nephew expressed, and those fortunate enough to find themselves comfortably placed in society should help those less lucky. Scrooge had a responsibility as an employer to pay his clerk, Bob Cratchit, a reasonable wage. The raise at the end of the book signalling Scrooge's evolving conscience. Lucinda Hawksley, who is Dickens's great-great-great-granddaughter, says, "He was really saying all of you are a bit like Scrooge. You go to church on a Sunday, you'll walk there in your finery, you'll pass starving children and not do anything about it." Dickens himself acknowledged that he broke out like a madman after having completed the book with such fervour in such a short space of time. And Christmas 1843 was a highly convivial fare in the Dickens household. The writer, famed for his love of exuberant celebration, threw himself into a whirl of festive frolicking and seasonal levity. The book was an immediate and gratifying success, the initial print run of 6,000 copies selling out in mere days. Its combination of a ghost story, plumbing the depths of despair, and then celebrating one man's redemption was irresistible. Not all reviews were ecstatic, but most people embraced its uplifting message. As Lucinda Hawksley says again, "A Christmas Carol was bringing back the true meaning of Christmas because it was felt in the late Georgian age that it was all about the food and the finery and clothing, and the true meaning had been lost, which was originally to do with charity." Reminiscent of today, she says, "There was also a belief that Christmas needed a renaissance, and it had become too commercial." Dickens's version reclaimed the spirit of Christmas in a way we still recognise. When Scrooge, overcome with freshly minted joy and intent on buying the Cratchits the biggest turkey imaginable, exclaims, "Hello! Whoop! Merry Christmas!" The very greeting itself was one that Dickens was establishing, as "Happy Christmas" was then more common. American writer Charles Norton said of Dickens in 1868, He helps us to celebrate Christmas with heartier cheer. For it's not just his literary character that he has done most. It is as a man of the largest humanity, who has simply used literature as a means by which to bring himself into relations with his fellow men. There are many linguistic legacies A Christmas Carol has bestowed. The expression, "Bah, humbug," entered the vernacular as the response to anything overtly sentimental, and Scrooge's name became a byword for anyone of miserly disposition. As Lucinda says, "I think A Christmas Carol is superb because it still resonates, and its appeal remains essentially timeless. It is a Victorian fable that speaks afresh to each generation. It's never been out of print, and its message of kindness, compassion, and benevolence remains as relevant now as on the first composition." Towards the end of the book, the reformed Scrooge, now a man oozing with infinite zest, resolutely promises, "I will honour Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all year." It is a philosophy Dickens fervently hoped mankind would copy. May that be truly said of us and all of us.
Finally, Christmas is fast approaching, and as this is the season of the year for quizzes, Sarah has compiled a fiendish one for us. The results will be in the next Outlook, so good luck, everybody.
Hello, and welcome to Santa Sarah's Christmas Quiz, otherwise known as the 12 Questions of Christmas. Right, let's make a start, shall we? Question 1. Mother Goose is a well-known pantomime character, but what is a female goose called? The male goose is called a gander, the baby geese are called goslings, but what is the female goose called? Question 2. Lule Lula, thy little tiny child, is the opening line of which carol? Question 3. Where does tinsel originate from? And the answer is not Primark or B&M's. Which country? Question 4. When was the first King's Speech transmitted? And I don't mean King Charles III, I mean back in the days. Question 5. In the film Love Actually, who played the leading man, the Prime Minister? Question 6. Infamous Christmas number 1, Mr. Blobby. But which television programme did he feature in? Question 7. And sticking with Christmas number 1s, in the much better Christmas song by Band-Aid, Do They Know It's Christmas, who sang the opening lines? It's Christmas time, there's no need to be afraid. Question 8. On the sixth day of Christmas, what did my true love give to me? Question 9. Who wrote the novel, The Christmas Carol? Question 10. Which country annually donates the Christmas tree to Britain that stands in Trafalgar Square? Question 11. Two of Santa's reindeers are called Donner and Blitzen, which are German words, but what does Donner und Blitzen mean in German? And finally, question 12. Which carol is credited as having been sung in the trenches in the First World War on Christmas Day when fighting stopped for just 24 hours? And that's been your Christmas quiz. Hope it's been a bit of fun. No prizes, but answers to follow a bit later.
That almost brings us to the end of this week's programme. So it's goodbye and happy Christmas from the Outlook team and from me, Peter Walters. Outlook's now having 2 weeks off, so the next edition will be recorded on Wednesday, January the 7th.